the Torah prohibits cooking milk and meat together. And if milk and meat are cooked together, then the resulting food is prohibited by the Torah. Prohibited in the sense that you're not allowed to eat it. Also prohibited in the sense that you're not allowed to derive any benefit from it at all. For example, you couldn't sell it and derive benefit from the sale price. Now, according to the Rambam, this particular prohibition is part of a series of prohibitions having to do with idolatry back in those days. Back in those days, the Ov Day of Avodah Zarah, the idol worshippers cut their hair and shaved their beards in a certain way, and therefore we're not allowed to do that. All kinds of things which were typical of idolatry in those days, the Torah prohibited, and this is part of that series of prohibitions. Now, this idea proposed by the Rambam has no known source in the Gemara or earlier rabbinic literature. It seems quite clear that this idea is an idea which originates with the Rambam, his proposal that the reason for the prohibition of milk and meat has to do with idolatry. However, recently, archaeologists in the study of ancient idolatries in the Near East have indeed discovered a number of ancient idolatrous practices which involve the cooking of milk and meat together and the offering of that milk and meat to various idols. So although there is no source for the Rambam's idea in Talmudic literature, historically speaking, it seems to be correct. In any event, if the milk and meat is not cooked together, it's not a cheeseburger, but it's cold cheese and salami sandwich. If the milk and meat are cold together, that's not a Torah prohibition at all, because the Torah prohibition has to do with cooking. If the milk and meat are cold, it's a rabbinic prohibition, lest one come to cook it, lest one come to eat it when it's cooked together. But cold is a rabbinic prohibition. Now, what I want to talk about today is the rabbinic prohibition of milk and meat. But before I come to that, let me just indicate to you unusual opinion of one of the Rishonim, one of the great authorities of the Middle Ages, the Bali Tur. A unique opinion holds as follows. When the Torah says, Lo tivashel, do not cook milk and meat together, what does livashel, what does cook mean? Well, cooking might mean different things to different people. Some people might think that cooking is boiling. Some people might think it's roasting or frying or sautéing or poaching. There are many different ways to cook. According to this opinion, the Torah was prohibiting boiling milk, boiling meat in milk, using milk to boil meat. That's what the Torah was prohibited. Other things which we might categorize as cooking, like a frying, baking, roasting, that's not what the Torah prohibited. And therefore, according to this view, and I say it's a unique view of just one of the authorities, all the other posts could disagree with this, according to this unusual view, a cheeseburger is not boiled, is only fried, and therefore only a rabbinic prohibition and not a Torah prohibition. Why is it interesting to know? Why is it important to know what is a Torah prohibition and what is a rabbinic prohibition? So it's really very important to know the difference, because in some unusual circumstances, and just about everyone at some point in their life finds themselves in unusual circumstances. Unusual circumstances are unusual, but in the course of your lifetime, you usually, most people will find themselves in unusual cases, usually, at some point in their life. You got the idea? The problem is as follows. Someone who finds himself in a situation where he has no choice, he must violate some halacha. Doing nothing will violate a halacha. Turning left will violate a halacha. Turning right will violate a different halacha. Standing still will violate something else. The other is whatever you do will violate something. Well, you have to choose which prohibition to violate. And of course, you're going to want to violate the less severe prohibition. You find yourself in a life-threatening situation where you're starving to death and there are only two kinds of food available to you. One is a Torah prohibition, the other is a rabbinic prohibition. So of course you'll choose the rabbinic prohibition to save life with rather than the Torah prohibition. So it's unusual if these circumstances arise, but believe it or not, most people encounter something like this at some point in their life. So you have to know what's what. Now, before we begin to look at the rabbinic prohibition of milk and meat together, after all, the Torah prohibition is something that we encounter fairly rarely. I mean, it's unusual that we would encounter meat actually cooked with milk together. But before we do that, let's look at the following situation. Prohibitions come in different levels. Some prohibitions are more severe. For example, Torah prohibitions are more severe than rabbinic prohibitions. Even within the category of Torah prohibitions, there are different levels of severity. Some Torah prohibitions are chayav misa. If you violate them, the death penalty is called for. Other prohibitions are Torah prohibitions, but not so severe. No death penalty involved. Even amongst those Torah prohibitions which have death penalties, there are four different levels of death penalty, four different ways that the death penalty can be imposed, a ranking of what's more severe, even within the category of Torah prohibitions which carry the death penalty. So whatever the two prohibitions are, whatever you're faced with, you can compare the levels and see which is more severe and which is less severe. Now, in a situation where there's no death penalty from the Torah, in a situation where there's no Torah prohibition at all, in a situation where there's also no rabbinic prohibition at all, what is left is permitted. When we say that something is permitted, you're allowed to eat it, or whatever the action might be. When we say something is permitted, what we mean is none of the many levels of prohibition apply to your situation. If none of the many levels of prohibition apply to your situation, what's left when there's no prohibition, what's left is something that is permitted, and therefore mutar. Permitted means neither more nor less than none of the levels of prohibition apply in this case. This means that two things which are permitted are equally permitted. In things which are mutar, things which are prohibited, in things which are mutar, things which are permitted, there are no levels. You can't be more permitted and less permitted. Permitted is what is left in a situation where there are no prohibitions. Prohibitions come in many levels and can be weighed, can be compared with each other. Heter, things which are permitted, are all equally permitted. You have two dishes of food. Both of them are permitted. They are equally permitted. One cannot ask which is better and which is worse. Things which are permitted are all equally permitted. Now, one more point before we talk about the rabbinic prohibition of milk and meat. There are unusual circumstances which arise in connection with the Torah prohibition. In secular wisdom, there is such a thing as chemistry. Chemistry, in secular wisdom, is the study of the molecule. Molecules are these little critters. They're usually too small to see. And nonetheless, there are many people out there who are studying them. And the people who study these tiny critters, too small to see, most of them are too small to see, they're called chemists. Now, these guys, these chemistry fellows, have developed methods to figure out what something is. And give them a substance, you don't know what it is, and you say, hey, Mr. Chemist, can you figure out what this substance is? They have ways of doing it. They're fairly complicated and sophisticated ways of doing it. In fact, there's a whole field of spectroscopy which deals with exactly this issue. Now, it therefore becomes interesting from the halachic point of view. If we have a substance which is of halachic interest, for example, vegetable oil, and the question arises, is this vegetable oil, in point of fact, pure vegetable oil, or is there some animal fat mixed into it? If it's pure vegetable oil, then from the kashrus point of view, we're happy, and we'll call it parva and permitted. If, on the other hand, there is some animal fat mixed in, that's from the halachic point of view, is a big problem, obviously. If the animal fat is kosher, so the product will be fleishig. If the animal fat is treif, so the product will probably be treif. This is something which a chemist might be able to help us with. After all, the lipids which come from animal fats, the molecules are a little bit different than the molecules which come from vegetable fat, vegetable oils. And therefore, a chemist can tell the difference in a chemistry laboratory. What about margarine? Is the margarine made entirely out of ingredients which have no milk origin? Or is there something of milk origin mixed in with the margarine, which turns out to be a very important question from the halachic point of view? So you turn to the chemist, and you ask the chemist to analyze the vegetable oil, the margarine, whatever it is. And incidentally, regarding the halachic admissibility of the chemical analysis, Rav Herzog, back in the 1940s, early 1950s, wrote that since the great rabbi in the previous generation, in the beginning of the 20th century and the end of the 19th century, since the great poskim of Europe already gave their approval to chemical analysis in establishing the kashrus of a product, since that's a halakhic decision which was already reached back at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century by the great poskim in Europe, now that chemical analysis, he's writing this back in the back in the late 1940s, early 1950s, they were still doing flame tests in order to figure out what's what, but surely now that the chemical science has advanced so much further and is so much more precise and so much more accurate than it was back in the days when the poskim already gave their approval for chemical analysis, today, all the more so, the poskim should rely on the validity of the chemical test. So we bring the oil or the margarine or whatever it is to the chemist, and we say, please perform your test on this and tell us whether there's anything of meat origin, anything of milk origin in this product. The chemist then says, but maybe this product has milk and meat in it. And my testing procedure requires cooking the sample. I'm going to have to heat the sample in order to do a spectroscopic analysis of it. I'm going to have to heat and vaporize the sample in order to figure out what's in it. What happens if I determine that there are both milk origin and meat origin ingredients in this product? I'll be guilty of cooking milk and meat together. That's how I do the chemical test. I have to cook it and vaporize it, and only the vapor will be tested. Oh, well, if there's a possibility of there being milk and meat here, now the chemist is in trouble. After all, the rule is sveika deraisa lachumra. If there's some doubt about the possibility of violating a Torah prohibition, so of course you want to be strict, Of course, you don't want to do anything which will get you into a situation of possibly violating a Torah prohibition. The very chemical test should be prohibited because it might turn out to be milk and meat together, and if that's a possibility, then the cooking of the heating of the test sample should be prohibited. Regarding this particular problem, the mainstream thinking of the poskim is that the prohibition of cooking milk and meat together is a prohibition if you cook milk and meat together in a positive way, in a helpful way, in a way which is actually going to produce something which is useful, food or some other product which is useful. If, on the other hand, the heating of the product, the heating of the milk and meat together is destructive, for example, back in the old days when rubbish was burnt, now we are wiser and no longer burn our rubbish, but back in the old days when rubbish was burnt, it was okay to throw away leftovers from milchic meals and leftovers from milchic meals, cheese and meat together into the rubbish, even though it's going to be burnt together, cooked together, because that's destructive. The whole purpose of the cooking there is destructive, not intending to make any food at all, and therefore you don't need separate garbage, you don't need separate rubbish, you don't need separate facilities to burn milchic and fleischic rubbish. They can all be burnt together because that's destructive. And similarly, in the chemistry laboratory, since the heating of the sample for chemical analysis is destructive, the part which has been heated and vaporized is not going to be good for anything afterwards, surely not edible, surely not good for anything, since the chemical analysis procedure is destructive of the sample, it's permitted even if it turns out to be milk and meat. So if you want to go into the field of chemistry, food chemistry, it's okay.
Two questions. One is not going to be fine, but if you take, now we're going to make engineering, and
that sounds wicked.
If you take a horse, can you make it just with clothing? Can you
push it better? You could do that? Yeah, the Spallanzani, are you into, you remember the Renaissance in Italy? That was really a good time, the Renaissance in Italy. It was a lot of fun. A lot of fun back in Renaissance Italy. Well, one of those monks by the name of Spallanzani did an experiment, and the experiment which he did changed the thinking of biologists greatly. Prior to Spallanzani in the Italian Renaissance, it was commonly believed that many creatures come into being through spontaneous generation. What does that mean? That means that lice, you know, lice that people get in their hair, lice are not born or hatched through sexual reproduction. Rather, they come into being out of flesh. Maggots are not born or hatched, do not reproduce sexually. Instead, they come into being from putrid meat. Fruit flies come into being not through sexual reproduction, but rather fruit flies come into being from rotten fruit, and so forth and so on. Many creatures, particularly small ones, were believed to come into being through spontaneous generation prior up to the Italian Renaissance. Now, halakhically speaking, this turns out to be a very important idea, because it says in the Gemara that on Shabbos, you know, one of the 39 categories of prohibited work on Shabbos is shochet. You're not allowed to kill any creature. Killing any creature, for example, slaughtering an animal, is one of the 39 prohibited categories of labor on Shabbos. Not allowed to do it. Nonetheless, the Gemara says, it is permitted, flat out permitted, no prohibition at all, it is permitted to kill lice on Shabbos. Why is it permitted to kill lice on Shabbos? Because lice come into being through spontaneous generation, and the Torah only prohibited killing those creatures which come into being through sexual reproduction. And therefore lice, no objection to killing it at all. Now this halacha in the Gemara is quoted by the Rambam. After it's in the Rambam, it appears in the Tur, it's in the Shulchan Aruch, it's in the Mishnah Brura. All the great poskim, generation after generation, have been quoting this halacha, and still, in any contemporary handbook, like the Mishnah Brura, on Hilchos Shabbos, you'll find the same halacha quoted. Then Spallanzani, that Italian monk from the Renaissance, he did a little experiment. The experiment he did was he took muffin soup, lamb soup or lamb stew, and he put it into a glass flask, sealed the flask. No air in, no air out. Nothing goes in, nothing goes out. The stew is in the glass flask. He then put the glass flask into boiling water, left it in the boiling water for a long period of time, let it cool off, removed the flask, and put it aside for a week's time. After a week's time, he went back and studied the lamb stew inside the glass flask. He opened up the flask, studied the stew very carefully with a microscope, and saw not a single living cell in the flask, which led him to the conclusion that every living creature has parents. There's no such thing as spontaneous generation. If there were such a thing as spontaneous generation, then we would expect maggots and fruit flies and other creatures to be growing inside the flask together with the mutton stew. There are no living creatures in there. He took that as proof that there's no such thing as spontaneous generation, and every creature has parents. Once this experiment was revealed to the world, it was reproduced many times, and very quickly, everyone in the world of biology became convinced of the truth of this idea. There is no such thing as spontaneous generation, and every living creature has parents, even down to the one-celled creatures. Every living one-celled creature split from another living one-celled creature. Even one-celled creatures do not come into being spontaneously. Now, this idea more or less dominates modern chemistry, modern biology. I remember Mrs. Cohen in the third grade taught us this. And if Mrs. Cohen in the third grade knew about it, so I suppose all the real biologists know about it as well. Now, think about it for a moment. We have here a little bit of a clash, do we not? We have here a little bit of tension between modern biology, since the days of the Renaissance anyway, and the halacha as formulated by the Gemara and all the poskim in subsequent generations. The halacha as formulated by the Gemara and accepted by the poskim in all subsequent generations permits, flat out permits, killing lice because they come into being through spontaneous generation. The biologists are telling us, poo-poo, there's no such thing. If we take the biological approach, we have a Torah prohibition to kill lice on Shabbos if we accept what the scientists say. If we reject what the scientists say and accept only the halachic sources, it's entirely permitted to kill these critters on Shabbos. What to do? What to do? What to do? Let me point out in passing that it seems to me quite clear that errors, scientific errors in earlier generations, scientific errors, mistakes in antiquity or any earlier generation, divide into two categories. There are some kinds of mistakes which they made in earlier generations or in antiquity where we can be very forgiving of them. They could not have known better They did not have microscopes in antiquity, and therefore they misunderstood quite a number of things. Well, of course they misunderstood that. They could not have known better, that they made observations as well as they could and drew the most rational conclusions, the most reasonable conclusions they could from the observations they were able to make. And we can smile on that, even though they were wrong. On the other hand, there are also errors which they should have known better. They should have known better. And think for a moment about this particular case. Have you ever seen a louse? Lice are small, but perfectly visible to ordinary vision. And if you have ever combed out lice from hair, as I occasionally have combed out lice from my children's hair, if you comb lice out of hair, you see the lice crawling around. And while you comb, you're also combing out their eggs, right? The eggs of lice are called nits. And when you comb out the hair of someone who is infested with lice, you want to not only get out all the lice, you want to get out the eggs. You need a very fine tooth comb for the purpose. If you comb out only the lice with a regular comb, the comb's not fine enough to get the eggs out. Well, the egg's just going to hatch, and the hair is going to be reinfested with lice in a day or so, and you haven't accomplished very much. Actually, that's probably not true. I probably was not so precise here. Our archaeological findings here in Eretz Yisrael from the Second Temple period have found lice combs in archaeological excavations from the Second Temple period, from the Hellenistic period. And the lice combs which were found are not very fine at all. The lice combs which were found could comb out lice, but they were not fine enough to comb out eggs. Archaeologists know that they were lice combs because the combs were discovered with a lot of dead lice on them, but no eggs. The eggs slipped right through the comb, which means that even an ordinary comb is effective in dealing with lice infestation. The reason an ordinary comb is effective in dealing with lice infestation, even though the lice are left behind, is because you can use the comb repeatedly every day for a period of time, for a week and a half or so, and get out the lice, and the eggs which are left behind will hatch, and then you get out those lice before they have time to lay more eggs, and therefore if you comb rigorously with an ordinary comb, rigorously every day for around a week and a half or 2 weeks, you can eliminate a lice infestation that way, even though the eggs will be left behind. Similarly, the lice crawl up and down the hair, you know, but they survive by sucking blood from the scalp. That's how lice survive. They bring blood, the human blood, from the scalp. Rigorous combing might have the effect of breaking a leg. If you can succeed in just breaking a leg of a louse, it will not be able to walk down the hair stem to the scalp and feed again, and it will die. It will starve to death. So combing is effective, even if you don't remove the lice. Even if you can succeed in just breaking a leg on a louse, it will die from starvation pretty fast. Why is this interesting? The reason this is interesting is because although lice are small and their eggs are smaller, anyone who has combed out hair infested with lice will be happy to tell you that the lice are perfectly visible to ordinary human vision. You don't need a microscope for this one. The eggs, although small, are perfectly visible to ordinary vision. You don't need a microscope for this one. The entire life cycle of the louse is observable with ordinary vision. You don't need a microscope to observe the entire life cycle of the louse. With a little bit of patience, you can see the louse emerging from its egg. You can observe the hatching of the louse. With a little bit more patience, you can observe the mating of boy and girl louse, and with a little bit more patience, you will observe the laying of the egg, and then again the hatching. The entire life cycle is perfectly observable with ordinary vision. This is one you don't need a microscope for. This is one they should have known better. Now, this increases the tension between what it says in the Gemara and all the poskim, between, against what science has to say on the issue. Let me point out in passing that scientific observation, or observation in general, scientific observation is just more careful and more precise observation. Observation in general is often greatly influenced by our theories. Our theories, things we believe, often mold and control the way we see things. We often see things the way we are taught to see things. Even trained scientists, whose field it is to observe very carefully, they often also observe things the way they are taught to observe things, and only when there's later a scientific revolution and all of a sudden a new theory comes along, then people realize, oh, we didn't understand exactly what we were looking at. Now we realize more clearly what it is we are looking at. Observations change as scientific theories change. Let me give you a big example. You want a big example? Here's a big one. Leonardo da Vinci. Leonardo da Vinci was a great, also one of those Renaissance guys, right? He was one of those Renaissance guys, and he was a Renaissance man. And among other things, he was a great artist. He was a great artist, one of the world's all-time great artists. He was a very, very, very keen observer. When he drew a human face, his observation of the face was exquisitely precise, and his drawing was exquisitely precise. He was a very keen observer, and one of the world's all-time great artists. Now Leonardo da Vinci left us, among other things, notebooks full of anatomical drawings. He was very interested in the human form, and he left us with notebooks full of anatomical drawings, everything from fingers to noses to everything imaginable in the human body. He left us very, very exquisitely precise anatomical drawings. Now, hold that idea in mind for a moment and consider the following idea. The Gemara teaches us that the male sexual organs have two ducts, one tube for transporting urine, and a separate duct, a separate tube for transporting semen, and these two tubes end with two separate openings in the male genital organs. One opening for urine to come out, a second opening for semen to come out. That's what it says in the Gemara, and that's what it says in all of the ancient anatomical textbooks. I have in mind specifically Galen, and everyone who copied Galen. Now, it seems to me unlikely that there is any male over the age of 8 who is not observed, that it's simply not true. I doubt that there's any male over the age of 8 who has not already observed that there is a single opening, not two openings, in male genital organs. Nonetheless, science taught from late antiquity through the Middle Ages into early modernity, science taught that there are two openings and two ducts, which is simple observation indicates this is not true. If one looks at the anatomical drawings of Leonardo da Vinci, when he comes to his exquisitely precise anatomical drawings of male genital organs, he depicts two separate openings. And this is Leonardo da Vinci, who was one of the keenest observers of all times, one of the finest, most precise, exquisitely precise artists of all times. In his anatomical drawings, there are two openings in male genitalia. Now, I just present this as a very strong example of theory influencing the way we observe things. When he made his observations, were formed and molded more by the theory he had learned than by his actual vision. And this is true with scientists everywhere and all times. Can I return to the question of lice and the tension between the scientific view, which will prohibit killing them, and the halachic view, which permits killing them? Let me return to this idea. Among the great contemporary rabbis who deal with this issue is Rav Eliyahu Dessler. Rav Eliyahu Dessler was originally from Eastern Europe, originally from Lithuania. He survived the Holocaust. After the Holocaust, he ended up in England and then in Eretz Yisrael. And he wrote a book called Michtav Me'Eliyahu, which is probably the single most influential book in matters of machshava, in matters of Jewish thought, within the yeshiva world. And the yeshiva world is a book of immense influence. And he deals, in addition to hundreds of other issues of machshava, Jewish thought, he deals with this problem as well. Here is his approach. His approach is as follows. He says, Chazal, the rabbis of the Gemara, the Rishonim, the great medieval authorities, they were not scientists. Well, mostly, some of them might have been scientists, but in general, they were not scientists. And even those who were scientists, a few of them were scientifically trained, even those who were scientists, the rabbis in the rabbinic tradition are merely reporting to us scientific wisdom which was accepted in their days. And the scientific information given to us by the rabbis of the Gemara and all subsequent generations is neither better nor worse than scientific wisdom as it was accepted in their days. And if it's wrong, it's wrong, and that's all there is to it.
Openly admit that there's room for mistake, for error, or fault. And in...
One hopes so.
But however, with more religious context, the more we typically say they're all right. And that seems to be a big difference. We say that we have truth, and the scientific community, so we're not saying we're true, but we're finding truth.
Right. So yes. Every scientist must be willing to receptive to new data, new experimental findings, new information, which will overturn everything that he believed before. Every scientist must be willing. Otherwise, science could not move forward, could it? The history of science is largely the discovery that everything we used to believe is false, and something else is true. Rav Dessler embraces the idea that from the rabbis of the Gemara down to whatever generation, the scientific information they convey to us, whether it's medical science or any other kind of science, the scientific information they convey to us is neither better nor worse than contemporary science in their days. And if it's wrong, it's wrong. Let me see if I can address your first question. On the other hand, he says, Chazal, the rabbis of the Gemara, and the great poskim in all subsequent generations would never have told us that we are permitted to kill lice on Shabbos if they were not quite sure that that's correct. As far as halacha is concerned, everything in the Gemara and the subsequent poskim is halachically correct, even if the scientific basis for it is crazy. The resolution between these two ideas, according to Rav Dessler, is as follows. Chazal, the rabbis of the Gemara, were the recipients of Torah Shebaal Peh. Right? Torah Shebaal Peh began in the generation of Moshe Rabbeinu with the Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah in Har Sinai. The Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, was transmitted generation after generation from Rebbe to Talmud, and the rabbis, the great rabbis of the Gemara, were the recipients of that tradition. That tradition, since the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, taught from Rebbe to disciple through the generations. That tradition taught on Shabbos you are not allowed to kill any creature except lice. That is the halacha which was transmitted generation after generation. Now, the rabbis in the Talmudic period asked themselves, why? What's the difference between lice and anything else? And they said, you know, biologists teach us that there's a big difference between lice and other creatures. Biologists teach us that lice come into being through spontaneous generation. That's probably the reason why through the generations we were taught that you're not allowed to kill any creature on Shabbos except lice. Chazal took contemporary science in their days and used it to explain a halacha which they knew to be true on the basis of tradition. The halacha they knew to be true, the explanation of the halacha was the best explanation they could propose in terms of modern science as it was known in those days. The science is wrong, so the science is wrong. The explanation of the halacha is wrong, so the explanation of the halacha is wrong. But the halacha is correct. Apparently. The science in the Gemara is just contemporary science as it was known in those days and is neither better nor worse than any science in those days. The halacha in the Gemara is surely true. The science which is used to explain it might or might not be valid. No. Of course, in every generation, we should do the best we can to try to understand and explain the halacha, and therefore this is a task which falls upon me and you equally. We should try to propose a new explanation which will work better, but if we can't explain it, we still know what the halacha is.
Not that long ago, chicken was becoming to be introduced to the rotten pork and the pork. And yet it was said that this is not true origin for the story in 1996. In fact, all the chicken can be chicken up.
All meat should be treated like the biohazard that it is until it is fully cooked. Not only pork, for goyim who eat pork, but even kosher beef, kosher chicken, should be treated as the biohazard which it is until it's fully cooked. The number of serious diseases that you can get from any raw meat is scarifying. So let's go one step further. I presented one approach, the approach of Rav Dessler. Now let me see if I can suggest a different approach. It says in the Gemara that the third day after Bris Milah, the third day after ritual circumcision, is a day of special danger to the life of the baby, and therefore it is essential, according to the Gemara, to bathe the baby in warm water on the third day after Bris Milah. That's what it says in the Gemara. If you don't bathe the baby in warm water on the third day after Bris Milah, life-threatening complications can set in. So according to the Gemara. Therefore, if the third day after Bris Milah falls on a Shabbos, of course one should prepare the hot water in advance of Shabbos for bathing the baby on Shabbos. If for some reason that water is spilled out, lost, if for some reason the water was not prepared in advance before Shabbos, since the hot water is needed to bathe the baby in a life-threatening situation, failure to bathe the baby in hot water on the third day after Bris Milah is life-threatening, so if you have to, you can even heat the water on Shabbos, even though heating water on Shabbos is cooking, and therefore one of the 39 categories of prohibited labor on Shabbos, this is a life-saving procedure and you're allowed to do it. That's what it says in the Gemara. The Rambam quotes the same halacha. It's in the Tur, it's in the Shulchan Aruch. All the great poskim from the Gemara through the Shulchan Aruch quote the same halacha. Now we come to the Magen Avraham. The Magen Avraham is probably the single greatest commentary ever written on the Shulchan Aruch. Family name is Gumbiner. So if you tell someone that you know the opinion of Rabbi Gumbiner, they won't know who you're talking about. You have to say it's the Magen Avraham. Magen Avraham lived in the 17th century in Poland. And in the 17th century in Poland, he wrote, Einenu Haraot. Our eyes see, we have the testimony of our eyes, that the third day after circumcision is not more dangerous than the first or the second. There is no special danger to the baby on the third day after Bris Milah, after circumcision. Nishtane hateva, the very fabric of reality has changed. The facts have changed back in the days of the Gemara. The third day after Bris Milah was a day of life-threatening, a threat to life for the baby. The baby had to be washed in hot water. Today, that's simply not true. The facts have changed. The fabric of reality has changed. Today, the third day after circumcision is not a day of special danger to the baby. Therefore, even though it says in the Shulchan Aruch that it's permitted to heat water to bathe the baby on the third day after Bris Milah, nowadays, in the 16th century in Poland, it's simply prohibited because there is no threat to the baby's life on the third day after Bris Milah. Shinui hateva, change in the facts, leads the Magen Avraham to a corresponding change in the halacha. The halacha must be correctly altered. The halacha must be altered in order to bring it in line with what we know the facts to be. That was the approach of the Magen Avraham, and just about all subsequent poskim copied the view of the Magen Avraham that today, because of the shinui hateva, the change in the facts, today it's prohibited to heat water for this purpose. Correct. Apparently. Yeah, I'll give you a couple of examples which go the other way. Let me give you another example, and you'll see how it works. There's a prohibition in the Torah of Ptua Daka. Ptua Daka is a prohibition in the Torah prohibiting men from getting married. Men are prohibited to get married if they are Ptua Daka, if their genital organs have been crushed. A male whose genital organs have been crushed and therefore Eino Molid, therefore is infertile, cannot produce children, is not allowed to get married. That's a prohibition of the Torah. Now, the Gemara, of course, has a lot to say about defining exactly what is and what is not considered Ptua Daka. Since we have a prohibition of the Torah here, we have to know who is permitted to get married, who is prohibited to get married. We have to know exactly what lesions, we have to know exactly what falls into the category of Ptua Daka, so we will know who is not allowed to get married. in the course of the discussion of the Gemara, the Gemara discusses the case of Nitav HaBeitza, a puncture of the testicle makes a man infertile and therefore prohibited from getting married. The Gemara even discusses a specific case of a specific man to whom this injury occurred. His wife subsequently became pregnant and gave birth, and the rabbis declared that baby to be a mamzer, to be a bastard, since the husband suffered this injury. The husband is therefore enomolid, infertile, and if the wife became pregnant and gave birth, it must be the result of adultery, and therefore the child was declared to be a mamzer, to be a bastard. This halacha of Nikah Beitza, a puncture in the testicle, is again quoted by the Rambam and all the subsequent poskim, and there's no machlokes, no disagreement regarding this. Hold that idea in mind for a moment, and let us consider the following question. In contemporary medical practice, male infertility is usually treatable. There's a couple which is infertile. They go to the doctor because they're infertile. The couple wants to have babies. The first job is to figure out why they are infertile. Is it the woman who's infertile? Is it the man who's infertile? Once you figure out what the problem is, once the doctor figures out what the problem is, then a course of treatment can be proposed. And in most cases, fertility can be restored. In order to figure out why a male is infertile, in order to figure out why he's infertile, before we can treat him, we have to know what the problem is, in order to figure out why a male is infertile, a testicular biopsy is required. A testicular biopsy means taking a little bit of material from that part of the body to look at under a microscope, and through microscopic examination be able to figure out what the problem is. And once we know what the problem is, then of course a treatment can be proposed. And most of these cases, Baruch Hashem, most of these cases can be happily resolved, and the couple can be treated and have babies in the normal way. But think about it for a moment. The medical procedure for curing infertility, the medical procedure which works, and indeed cures infertility, involves a procedure which, according to the Gemara, makes the husband infertile and prohibited from being married, has to get divorced. Here we have an example. Another example of modern scientific information being at odds with what it says in the Gemara, and what are we supposed to do? Are we supposed to say that any male who has undergone this medical examination is prohibited from being married, or shall we say he's been cured and now he is fertile and there should be no objection to his marriage? Rav Moshe Feinstein, in a published tshuva, takes exactly the approach of the Magen Avraham, Shinui Hateva Nishtanu Hatvaim. Back in those days, this particular lesion, this particular accident, led to infertility and therefore a prohibition to get married. Nowadays, Einenu Haro'ot, we see with our own eyes that the facts have changed, and the halacha must be changed accordingly in order to bring the halacha in line with what we know the facts to be. And therefore, they're allowed to remain married. And in general, the treatment is successful and they'll be able to produce children. Can we get back to the question of milk and meat for a moment? We've moved a little bit away from our focus. Milk and meat is usher midrabanan when it's cold together. And the question arises, how close does the milk and meat have to be together in order for the rabbinic prohibition to apply? Now, obviously, a cheese and salami sandwich, where the cheese and salami are touching each other, that's called together, and that's a rabbinic prohibition. That's clear. But what if the milk and meat don't actually touch each other? What if they're just on the same table together? Well, even being on the same table together is close enough for the rabbinic prohibition to apply, and therefore, if you have two people eating at the same table, you are at your place of work, and you brought your cheese sandwich to work, and your colleague, who's also Torah observant, has brought his salami sandwich to work, and you're eating lunch together at your desk or his desk, you can't have the salami sandwich and the milk sandwich on the same table. You're at a public picnic bench, a public picnic table, and you've brought your cheese sandwich, and a neighbor has brought his salami sandwich. You can't be on the same table, together. That's called close enough to be prohibited. And what you have to do is have some kind of mechitza, some kind of interruption between the milchik and fleishik food, either a physical interruption between them, put some object on the table to act as a mechitza, or separate tablecloths would also do the job. If you have two separate tablecloths on the same table, one person eating milchik, one eating fleishik, that's enough of a separation to permit that. Similarly, if you have bits of meat stuck between the teeth, a few hours ago I ate a fleishik meal, and I've not had an opportunity to floss and brush my teeth, and there are still bits of meat stuck between my teeth, and now I drink milk or cheese. That's also called together. That's also called milk and meat together, and prohibited, which is why the different minhagim have a six-hour waiting time, 4 hours, 3 hours, 1 hour waiting time in order to separate the milk and meat. In addition, you cannot have, it's a rabbinic prohibition, to make milchik bread. Milchik bread is a rabbinic prohibition. Bread is made by kneading flour and liquid. Usually you use water. But if you put some milk into the dough, and now you have milchik bread, that's a rabbinic prohibition. Just to bake the bread is prohibited, because bread, we are accustomed to bread being parva. Since we're accustomed to bread being parva, we're accustomed to eating bread together with meat, and therefore, Chazal were afraid that if the bread is milchik, you will come to eat it together with meat, and that's prohibited just to make the bread. If you wish to bake milchik bread, there must be some siman, some indication in the bread itself at the time of baking, that some sign which will indicate to you that it is milchik. The bread must be of a distinctive shape that will indicate to you that it's milchik. That shape, oh, everyone knows that shape of bread is milchik. If the shape of the bread is such that it's distinctive and will indicate to you that it's milchik, that is what is necessary in order to permit milchik bread. In Yerushalayim, if you ever visit Yerushalayim, the minhag in Yerushalayim, and this is only in Yerushalayim, the following minhag, as far as I know, is limited to Yerushalayim. Maybe there are other places which follow this minhag, but I don't know of them. The minhag in Yerushalayim is triangular for milchik, rectangular for parva. If you visit Yerushalayim, you will know that in Yerushalayim people like to eat this thing, they call it burekas. Burekas is dough with some kind of filling in it. The filling might be parva, like mashed potatoes. The filling might be milchik, like cheese. Burekas, which are made in Yerushalayim, not brought to Yerushalayim from other places like the Nebrak, but the burekas which are made in Yerushalayim, the milchik ones are triangular, the parva ones are rectangular. And that in general, therefore, applies in Yerushalayim. Of course, if you go to a burekas stand, they might be selling burekas which were made in Bnei Brak, in which case this rule might not apply. But burekas made here, that's the rule. Similarly, one cannot bake or roast milk products and meat products in a single oven simultaneously. If you have milk and meat going simultaneously in the same oven, that is called close enough to be prohibited, unless it's a large oven. You have a large oven and it's piv patuach lamala. If it's a large oven and there's an opening on the top to let steam out, if there's an opening on the top to let steam out and it's a large oven, then you can have milk and meat, cheese and meat going simultaneously, being baked simultaneously in the same oven, and that's okay. Well, the size, according to the Shulchan Aruch, which is on the second sheet here, the size, according to the Shulchan Aruch, is 12 esronim. 12 esronim. Now, an isaron is the minimum size of dough which requires challah being taken out of it. 12 times that is the size of a tanur gadol, a large oven. Now, as you know, there are two different theories which are in practice today in calculating rabbinic sizes. One, the most common approach, is that of Rav Avraham Chaim Noy. Rav Avraham Chaim Noy was the Rav of the Bukharim, right over here in Yerushalayim, back in the days of Rav Kook. He happened to have been a Chabad Chassid, and his book on measurements, centimeters and grams, is the most influential book, the most widely accepted book on converting halachic measures into modern system. Since we're talking about 12 esronim, and each isaron is 43.2 eggs, the volume of 43.2 eggs. So 12 times 43.2 gives you the volume of 518.4 eggs. According to Rav Avraham Chaim Noy, the halachic volume of a single egg is 45 cubic centimeters, which means, according to him, the minimum size of a large oven is a little bit over 23 liters. Which is a little bit less than 1 cubic foot in the American system. 1 cubic foot is not very big. Almost all our household ovens are bigger than that. The Chazon Ish, on the other hand, and this is the minority view, the Chazon Ish holds that a kibetza, the halachic size of an egg, is a little bit bigger, twice the size almost, 100 cubic centimeters, and therefore his size for a large oven is around twice the ordinary approach. He holds it for an oven to be large, it has to hold over 51 liters. That's about 1.5 cubic feet. Now think about it for a moment. A bag of milk is 1 liter. Actually, a bag of milk is a little bit more than 1 liter because in addition to the milk, there's a little bit of air in there also. But an oven into which you could put 24 bags of milk is surely a tanur gadol, according to the halacha, according to most poskim, including the approach of Chabad and most communities. The machmirim, the strict people who follow the approach of the Chazon Ish, would require the oven to hold around 52 bags of milk in order to be large, according to this designation. It follows, therefore, that most ordinary household baking ovens are indeed tanur gadol. On the other hand, toaster ovens, the small ones, are surely tanur katan. It depends. If it's a gas-fired oven, all gas-fired ovens have vents on the top to let the steam out. You can't have a gas-fired oven without a vent. Electric-powered ovens, on the other hand, in general, do not have any vent in them, and therefore leaving the door open a little bit, although it's very wasteful of electricity, obviously, leaving the door open a little bit fulfills the halacha of piv patuach lamala, open to let the steam out, then you're okay. So, we've come to the end of our shiur today. We will pause with this, and in Yetzah Hashem, continue next week. Until then, have a good one.